Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Veterans Radio Podcast. Cyrus Raymond here from the Legal Help for Veterans Studio in Northville, Michigan. Just want to thank you for clicking on the download button on today's show. And also would like to thank podbros.com for having this podcast on their website. Head to their page and check out many other great podcasts. Until then, let's take it back to Jim Fossone right here on the Veterans Radio Podcast.
All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Jim Fossone for VeteransRadio.net, broadcasting from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Enjoy Dale Thronberry's interview about the history of Navy SEALs with Dick Couch and Bill Posey.
So let's get right into our story right now. And joining me on the program here at Veterans Radio is Dick Couch. And Dick has been on Veterans Radio many, many times. He is a well-known author. There's no doubt about that. And a friend of ours, Dwight Zimmerman, has had Dick on a number of times talking about his program. So let's see. He's the author of 18 books on the military and military special operations, co-authored the 2012 New York Times bestseller of Tom Clancy's An Act of Valor. A graduate of the Naval Academy, he served as a division officer aboard a Navy destroyer and with the Navy underwater demolition and SEAL teams. He has also served as a CIA case officer and advisor to the Commander, U.S. Special Operations Command. Been an analyst on Fox, MSNBC, ABC. Been a guest on NPR, The O'Reilly Factor, Hardball, Chris Matthews, Brian Lamb, C-SPAN. I didn't see anything in here about Veterans Radio. But he lives in Ketchum, Idaho. So, Dick Couch, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you, Dale, and sorry for the omission there.
we're getting there. We're growing every day. And so we're excited to have you back on the program, Dick, and I wanted to ask you, how did you get involved in writing this particular book?
Well, it was an interesting process there. The people from PBS came to me and asked me if I would consult on the program, and I thought, well, this sounds very interesting, a two-hour special on the history of Navy SEALs. And then they had contracted with Bill Doyle to write the book, and I knew of Bill Doyle's work. He wrote a very fine book on Travis Patrickman and his involvement in the Battle of Ramadi. So I knew of him. We talked it over, and so we became the authors of the book that's a companion to the PBS documentary. And it was kind of a fascinating undertaking. I've always written a little bit about the history of the SEAL teams in many of my books, but I've never really written a book on it. And got into it and delved into those stories, and so it was the teacher always learns more than the student. In this case, the writer learned an awful lot, and hopefully was able to pass some of that on to the reader.
Well, we're talking with Dick Couch here on Veterans Radio, and we're talking about the PBS special, The Navy SEALs, The Untold Story, and the accompanying book that he and Bill Doyle wrote. And let's get a little history of the SEALs. When did they, get started, or how did they get started?
Well, we trace our roots back to the Navy frogmen of World War II, and the Navy frogmen, like the SEALs, were born out of adversity. After the Battle of Tarawa, it became glaring that we needed to have information about hydrographic reconnaissance, and then we needed people to be able to go onto those landing beaches and deal with some of the obstacles. So it was a crash course in getting these people ready to go to Normandy and then certainly for our island hopping campaign across the Pacific. So it had to be done very quickly, and it had to be done, had to find some volunteers to do some things that are very difficult and very dangerous. The SEAL team's pretty much the same way. The late 50s, early 60s, there was a need for unconventional warfare, counterinsurgency type warfare, and so under the direction of John Kennedy, all services were to build up and enhance their capability in these areas. And so they took some of the veterans from the underwater demolition teams and retasked them with land duties, sea air land duties. And so the SEALs came to be just in time for Vietnam, and that's all they did for the next 10 years or so is combat operations in Vietnam. So I was born about a month before the Battle of Tarawa, so this has all taken place in my lifetime, even though I'm an old guy. It was a great thing to kind of see some of our history play out from the beginning up to the current time.
Well, I'm always fascinated. As you said, yes, sounds like we're both mid-century. Now, as they talk about furniture, that's the way they talk about us now. But how did you decide to go to the academy?
Well, it was one of those opportunities. I grew up in southern Indiana, and it's not like I was in Virginia or Pennsylvania or San Diego, where there's tremendous competition for these academy appointments. I was a pretty good high school runner, and that helped me a little bit there. And there was not very heavily competition within my district in Indiana, so I was able to slip in there with some of the some of my classmates who seemed to be a lot brighter and have a lot easier time of it, the academics there than I did. So I was very fortunate to go there, and I really appreciate, of all things I've done in my life, the opportunities that have come my way. No better opportunities ever presented itself than to attend the United States Naval Academy.
We've talked to a number of Naval Academy graduates recently, and they seem to have a very similar story. It sounds like it was a real learning experience. I wouldn't say it was a great time, like all the other academies. You know, the camaraderie and everything is probably the best part of the whole thing, not necessarily the discipline and all of the rules and regulations you have to follow, right?
Well, I think so, but it was and I'm sure that it's the same for those young men and women going to ROTC. It's exciting times. You think that you look back on them fondly, of course, but then not only was this a tremendous opportunity for somebody like me, just off the turnip truck from Indiana, but almost all of our lives from the time we're 20 to 24, 25, that era in there, those are very, very meaningful times. And to be at a service academy at that time in my life, I was very fortunate.
From what I understand, it's a great experience, and I was fascinated when I was in high school just going down to the Naval Academy, and I think we went up to West Point and said, wow, this looks really hard. And of course, at the time that we were looking at colleges, you know, both Army and Navy were big football schools. That's changed a little bit. Not much, though, from what I was over the weekend.
I think we spend maybe it gets a little too much attention, but no, Army, Navy, and Air Force, football occupies certainly a significant place at those institutions.
I want to go back to the book just a little bit, Dick, and when you were talking about the early frogmen, and one of the stories that I read, and I'm hoping that you can straighten me out on this, is that their breathing apparatus, they were breathing in their own air somehow and recirculating it, and could you explain that to me, or am I way off base?
No, I think you're quite right. The initially, you know, in Normandy, the clearing of those beaches, and same thing during World War II, those were in on the surface, do your job, and get back out, and it didn't involve underwater. They started underwater types of things in the late 40s. Certainly there was a little bit of that went on during the Korean conflict. But basically, they're combat swimmers, not divers. The diving apparatus that was first designed by Dr. Lamberson with the OSS was a recirculating, was an oxygen recirculation device. And what that does is it meters in pure oxygen into your breathing mix, and then it passes your breath through a scrubber, barium hydroxide, that removes the carbon dioxide. So it gives you, it has depth restrictions when you're on pure oxygen, but it also has tremendous endurance. So some of these rigs, you could be in the water for 6-7 hours, and there's no telltale bubbles, and they're much more efficient for military applications than are just the regular scuba where you're breathing air and when you exhale it goes away.
Okay.
They're more sophisticated, but basically even the modern diving rigs currently used by the SEALs operate on the same principle as Dr. Lamberson's scuba.
I found that really fascinating to read that, and I really encourage people, if you get the opportunity, to go to PBS. I don't know if they're streaming the program yet or not, but you might want to check their schedule to see when it's on again. It's the Navy SEALs, Their Untold Story. It's a two-hour documentary, and it's really worthwhile. You were in Vietnam, am I not correct?
Yes, and to your point there, if you do go on the PBS site, you can. You can watch that just anytime. Just pull it up on your laptop there and enjoy.
Two longtime Navy SEALs on the program. We've got Dick Couch, whose newest book is Navy SEALs, Their Untold Story. And joining me on the line right now is CW3 retired Bill Posey. Bill, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Dale.
All right. I asked Dick the same question. How did you get into the Navy and into the SEALs?
Captain Couch was very smart in what he did, but I went the other way. I took the enlisted way, and I was on a board of submarine. And at that time, it was a World War II type of submarine, and I hated it because I was an engine man, and we were constantly greasy. And we would go to bed on our off time, and we'd be so greasy, our head would slide off the pillow. So one day, I went to the Cobb, the chief of the boat, and I said, you know, I'm not a quitter, but I just can't take the submarine. I'll go into the Army. And we joined the Navy to stay out of the Army. And he said, Posey, do I have a deal for you? They're recruiting SEALs today, and if you go down and pass the test, you can be a SEAL team guy. And at that time, nobody knew what a SEAL team guy was. And I said, well, what is it? And he says, you lay on the beach, you at least have two girlfriends and all the beer you can drink, and the Navy will pay you to do that. Said, man, that is my gig. Let me go for that.
Boy, I wish they'd come and talk to me. I didn't know anything about that one.
So I just fell into it.
So you you were, when were you in Vietnam, Bill?
I was in Vietnam in late 68, 69.
And you were part of the Brown Water Navy, I'm assuming, as they call it?
I was the UDT guy.
Okay. And
underwater demolition team.
Did you go all over the country, or were you in a specific area, or how did that work?
No, we were on board. There was two or three different things that you could do, two or three different missions. And I was on board a destroyer escort, and we would go along the beaches of Vietnam getting ready for the big amphibious invasion that never happened. So we would do hydrographic reconnaissance. And then I was lucky enough to go down to Seafloat in the Mekong Delta and operate out of Seafloat on swift boats.
Okay. And Dick, what was your job in Vietnam?
Well, I spent a couple, I was, not unlike Bill, I toured aboard a destroyer, and I was a gunnery officer and first lieutenant aboard a combatant there. But then when I went back there with SEAL Team 1, I was a platoon commander, and this was in 70, 71, and operated in the lower Delta. We were primary task with going out and conducting unconventional warfare, which meant we were looking for senior Viet Cong leaders and going out at night and trying to interdict them and find them and engage them and fight the battle.
I know we're not allowed to tell any of the things that we did when we were in Vietnam, it seems, because 30, 40, 50 years later, part of my mission was to drop off Army long-range patrols, and they would go out, and it sounds like they did similar things, just kind of cause trouble, and if they could find somebody, either bring them back to interrogate them or make them disappear, whatever the scenario might be. Bill, I can't remember. I was talking to a good friend of yours, John Malloy, who happens to be an Army Ranger. I don't know if John's listening to the program or not, but he did mention that, some of your activities in Vietnam, were you doing the same types of thing as Dick was?
No, we had a different mission than Captain Couch. We were mainly trying to interdict people in coming down to Mekong or people who operated inside of the Delta there. And so we had a bit of a mission doing a lot of different things. Wherever they needed us, that's where they would send us. We would also support SEAL Team 1 at that time.
Okay.
Different operations.
Different operations. I'm sorry. I thought I read this in something when I was preparing for the program that one of you were involved in attempting to rescue POWs. Was that either one of you?
Captain Couch.
That would probably be me. You know, that was one of the missions that came to us as operating SEAL platoons. And then again, there was probably never more than six platoons operating in Vietnam and never more than maybe 100, 120 SEALs in country at any one time. But one of the missions that we were tasked with was personnel recovery when we'd find POW missions. And they're very much like today. You have to be very careful. You're trying to get in there and use the element of surprise to get to the captives before the enemy can get to them and either move them or hurt them. So we looked for those opportunities when they came to us, but that was just one of the missions that the SEALs were tasked with in that particular war.
Okay, because I was wondering, because when I was reading the article, it had mentioned something that right around the time of the Song Tay raid, there was another raid going on that was successful, but it wasn't that we'd never heard about. So maybe it was, maybe I'm just making the whole thing up. I don't know.
I conducted a raid, I think it was in November sometime, and it was almost within days of the Song Tay raid, and we got no Americans out, but we did get 19 Vietnamese soldiers that were being held in a POW camp, and managed to get in there and chase off the guard force and get them all out. And so it made us all feel pretty good to do something like that.
I would think so. Dick, how long did you spend in the Navy?
I was on the probably I'm not unlike Bill. I spent 5 years on active duty, and then I finished off the next 25 years as a reservist. And so I was basically around it, but only on active duty for 5 years, and certainly not in combat after that.
Okay.
So very, it was interesting the transition between the Dick Couch Vietnam guys and the new folks that went to Iraq, a completely different breed of folks. In the Vietnam era, everybody was much more humorous, and you got to do a lot of things because we were the only people out in the field. Everybody else, a lot of the Army wanted to stay behind the wire, so we could do a lot of things that we could not normally do.
Go ahead. I was going to say, so you had a little bit more freedom in Vietnam than you do now?
Absolutely. Yeah, it was really a lot of fun.
So anyway, joining us on the line right now are all guys are both retired, I'm assuming. Dick Couch, who's the author of the newest book on the Navy SEALs, Their Untold Story. He and Bill Doyle wrote this to go along as a companion piece for the two-hour PBS documentary that aired last Veterans Day, last Tuesday. And if you go to PBS, you can probably find it online and can watch it at your leisure. It's a great program to look at. Our other guest is Warrant Officer Bill Posey, and I love Warrant Officers. I don't know if I like W-3s, but I like Warrant Officers anyway, but who was in Vietnam and also ended up going back to Iraq.
A clarification that I might make that maybe Captain Couch wasn't familiar with, because he was a SEAL team guy, I was a UDT guy. And when they gave us our Trident, actually not a Trident, it was a UDT badge, and the officers had gold, where in UDTs, the enlisted had silver. And it was a little, we didn't have the ego, we had the musket and all that. So that's where the differentiation at the beginning, when they passed out those devices, came.
Okay. Well,
I was actually had a silver device on my chest.
Mm-hmm. And when did you become, Bill, I'm talking to Bill Posey here, when did you become a warrant officer, and how did that come about?
I became a warrant officer. I couldn't make Master Chief, and I wanted to make, I think every enlisted guy in the world wants to make Master Chief an E-9, and I had great evals, but at that time we didn't have a SEAL rate. So I was a CB, I was an equipment operator, CB, senior chief. And I went to the board guys after they had a board, and I said, I have great evals, why didn't you promote me? And they said, Posey, we wouldn't promote you if you were the last guy there, because you'll never do us any good as a master chief, because you've always been a SEAL. So then I applied to be a warrant officer, which turned out to be a great thing for me. I love warrant officers.
I'm sure a warrant officer today is a lot different than the warrant officer when I was one, because we were we considered ourselves the closest thing to a civilian that the military had. Because we didn't have any real command responsibility. Our only job was whatever it happened to be. Mine, you know, was flying helicopters. So,
yes, sir.
I like
good thing though about a warrant officer. You could be, you're neither fish nor fowl. So the beauty of it is, if you want to act like an enlisted guy, you can, and if you want to act like, at least for the Navy, an officer. So it gave me great latitude in Iraq to help supply my guys with a lot of stuff that I would have not normally been able to get. So it really worked out well for me at the when the Iraqi war started, because we went forward with nothing, and I was able to negotiate for supplies and everything because of my rank.
I did want to go into that a little bit. After 9/11, you went active duty again. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes, sir.
And then how did you end up in Iraq? Cause how old were you? They were what? 40-some?
I was 55 years old.
That's what I was going to say. I don't think you're running laps anymore at 55.
Well, actually, I still could pass a SEAL, the PRT, so fortunate there.
One of those, okay.
I've never been as athletic as Captain Couch. He was always a great athlete, but I could still pass. And they needed people to go forward. And when they activated, I was a reservist at the time, they asked for volunteers to go forward, and I was the first to raise my hand because I really liked going in that situation. And they said, Posey, you'll be the last person that we're sending. He says, you're too fat, you're too old, and you're too stupid, and you're not going forward. And I said, okay, we'll find out. But I was, I have an expertise in vehicles, and constantly our vehicles would constantly break down even before the war. So I was lucky enough that they sent me forward, and then I was able to get into the fight after that. It was a real good deal for me.
Well, it sounds like you were the scrounger, the guy who found everything that they needed, because in reading your little story I read about in the Orange County newspaper, there wasn't anything there when you first guys got there.
Yeah, we were lucky enough to, when we hit the Saddam Hussein airport, the Iraqis threw all their arms and all their flags and all their paraphernalia down, so we could trade that for different things that we needed, because we had no funding at that time to supply us with anything. So because I had been in Vietnam, I knew what was going to happen, and so I was lucky enough to acquire a lot of things to support our troops until we had our logistics tail come 6 months later.
Okay. Dick, when you got out of the active duty, what made you start writing these stories? How did that come about?
Well, it's I left active service and I joined the Central Intelligence Agency, where I did things that were not terribly dissimilar to what I was doing in the Navy, and I'm very proud to have been with that organization, as I was with the Navy. But as far as writing books goes, you reach a certain age where you can no longer maybe do these things, or you're no longer being tasked with doing those things. And I thought, well, maybe I can write about them. And I thought about writing spy stories, since I had a background in that. But then that was back when there was no books written about Navy SEALs, and so I wrote SEAL Team 1, and it turned out to be to sell an awful lot of books. And as a matter of fact, it's still in print. So I was very lucky to step into the first of the Navy SEAL books, and one thing led to another, and I was able to found out that my calling was writing stories and telling stories, and so I was very fortunate to move on from there.
Well, I know that I've read many of your books, and they are great stories, and I encourage our audience to go out and find the stories by Dick Couch. You have your own website, don't you, Dick?
Yes, www.dickcouch.com. My books are all on there, and they can be ordered just about anywhere, but all of the books that I have written are featured on that website.
Right, and I know that they can go to Amazon and probably find most of them there, too.
Absolutely.
Well, we certainly appreciate the effort that you've gone through in writing these stories. Otherwise, we wouldn't know about these amazing men, because they don't talk about themselves outside of their small little group. because I...
Well, at least they didn't used to.
Okay, so we've had this Navy SEAL come forward and say that he was the one who shot bin Laden. Dick, I'll start with you first. What was your reaction to that?
Well, I think that some of these tell-all books are inappropriate. The bin Laden operation was very much a team-centric operation, and it included, it was far-reaching. It included the intelligence gatherers, the analysts, combat support, aviation support. There were a lot of moving parts that put that team at that compound with that target inside. And then there were the members of that team there as well. So I think for one person to step forward and said, I did it, I'm the guy who pulled the trigger, I think it cheapens the fine work that was done start to finish to make that operation happen. So I was not, I'm kind of, I hate to be the guy in the glass house throwing rocks, but I think that both Mark Owen and Rob O'Neill, I think that they have no business speaking about these things. I think it's disingenuous, and it cheapens the service of those who are still on active duty, still looking for those good missions in the service of our country while they're using that position. Legally, they might be on shaky ground. Morally, I think they're definitely on shaky ground as far as the SEAL ethos goes. And I'd sure appreciate hearing what Bill has to say about that.
Bill, what do you think?
I'm a study of history, and the historian to Alexander the Great was Calnithesis, and he wrote great volumes on what Alexander the Great, and then other people picked it up, because there's nothing left of his work. Other people picked that up and were able to write their own volumes. And if he wouldn't have done that, we wouldn't have a clue, or we would have had a much broader perspective of what Alexander the Great did. I'm actually happy to see those guys do it so that they get the mystery out of it. And I think most secrets after 10 years or 5 years are pretty much out of the bag anyhow. The problem with it is, he's putting the thumb on himself with some type of retribution. Hopefully not, but you know that would be my only worry for him and his relatives there, that somebody might come and try to take it out on him.
That's what I thought. I mean, I watched him do an interview, and he was very. I mean, he was sharing responsibility with the other team members. It seemed as people. It's sort of like he started at the back of the line, and as people were, falling to the wayside or going into a different room, he kept moving up, and he ended up, in the top room of that building. But, I don't know. I kind of, my own personal opinion is I don't know if he should have come right out and said that he was the one that fired the shots. But as you point out, Bill, it does put his family at risk, I think. And also it takes away from the whole idea of the team aspect of everything that has to do with, you've got the SEALs, you've got the aviation units that are attached, you've got the intelligence units that are attached, and so on and so forth. And you got to wonder what might be said that might put some of those other men and or women, at risk.
Absolutely right.
Okay. Dick, I just wanted to ask you if you could describe what it was like for you to be a Navy SEAL and what it's like to be one today. And, you can say, what did you do, Daddy, in the war? You say, I was a SEAL. How does that make you feel?
I don't know that I've really even given it that much thought. I've always felt that being a Navy SEAL, I'm proud and privileged to have done that type of thing. But I felt it's just a warfare specialty. I think that a guy who's a Navy SEAL can take no more pride in his work than a Ranger with the 75th Ranger Regiment or a Special Forces soldier or a Marine Special Operator or any other service member of that, for that matter. I think that we're privileged to serve, and certainly you get a lot of accolades for the type of thing we do. But I think that any service member should take pride in the execution of service to their country. And good on them for doing so. As far as being a Navy SEAL, it was my way of serving. I'm proud to have done it. But I think there's the pride certainly is, and the rewards are certainly no greater than serving in any other branch of the military.
Do you think the Navy SEALs are getting too much publicity?
Well, it would seem that they do get an awful lot of publicity. We don't hear much from the Marine Special Operators, the Green Berets, and the Ranger Regiment, and I know they serve tirelessly. I've spent time with all of them. I never met a platoon sergeant with the 75th Ranger Regiment with less than 13 combat rotations. Never met one. So there's a lot of special operators working very hard and doing some great things over there, and they're not all just Navy SEALs. I'm parochial enough to be proud of my organization, but let's not forget all those other people that we never hear about, but they're over doing great work and in the service of their country.
Right, and I agree, because I just ran into somebody the other day who was an Air Force Special Forces guy, and I'd never even heard of the Air Force having anything like that.
Special tactics teams.
Yeah, that's what they are. Special tactics team. Bill, I know you're very proud of being a Navy SEAL, of course, and all the other things that you've accomplished. Well, gentlemen, I'm going to have to we have to wrap this up. I've only got about a minute to go, and I want to thank you both for being on Veterans Radio, and I'd love to have you both back on the program at some time in the future and tell a couple of war stories here and there. Okay.
Thank you, Dale.
Thank you, Dale.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.